Hello, and thank you for listening to this week's episode of Hereabouts, Asian American Midwest Radio. Hereabouts is produced by WFHB and Indiana University's Asian Culture Center. We ask critical questions about identity, culture, community, and shared assumptions. We air every other Wednesday from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. in the evening. Today, I'm here with Awais, who studied loss and damage at IU Bloomington, and we will be talking about the implications of climate change, climate justice in the context of the Asian diaspora or community, and steps we can take as students to help combat climate change. So, thank you so much for being on the podcast. Would you like to tell us a little bit more about yourself to start off?
Thank you both so much for having me. My name is Awais Khalid. I'm an international student from Pakistan. I'm in my second year of my master's degree. I'm doing a master's in public affairs from the O'Neill School at IU. My concentration is currently international environmental policy, but the areas that I'm very interested in are climate justice, specifically for the Global South. That's the research that I've been doing, and that also then intersects very closely with conversations about loss and damage.
Perfect. Yeah. So you mentioned you're from Pakistan. I'm also an international student. I'm from Thailand. A lot of people like to ask me why I chose IU. So I guess I'd also like to follow up on your introduction. So like, what made you choose IU and O'Neill?
So I'd been working in Pakistan before this, and I also did my undergraduate in anthropology from a liberal arts college in Lahore in Pakistan, where a lot of my work was in policy. I did work on healthcare. I did work on education. I work very closely with the government on trying to solve some very difficult problems that plague the country. But some of my earlier work that I did when I was in my undergraduate was on snow leopard conservation. And I feel like when I was doing work on healthcare, when I was doing work on education, it kept sort of sending me back to the work I had done with snow leopard conservation specifically. And I wanted to go back and study the climate more because I found that that's what my calling was. So when I was thinking about grad schools and going back to school, I found that IU's program, especially the O'Neill program, does a great job at bringing policy concerns together with environmental issues as well. It's one of the very few public schools that do a very good job at bringing both public policy and environmental concerns together. And so here I am in Bloomington.
Lovely, lovely. Well, we're glad you're here in Bloomington. Yeah, and O'Neill is such a great place. It's I'm in the Hamilton Luger School, but I spend a lot of time in O'Neill, and I have a lot of friends who study public policy and law at O'Neill. So I've heard great things about the curriculum and the faculty members as well. You also said, so you worked prior to pursuing a master's degree. So I guess kind of in the same vein, like, do you have an idea of what you would want to do after you complete your master's here at IU? Do you want to like continue on with research, or do you have something specific in mind if you're comfortable sharing?
Yeah. Well, one of the things I didn't say in my introduction was also that I'm a Fulbright scholar here at IU, and part of the contract that I have with the Fulbright is that I must also then go back to the country that I've come from and serve my time serving the country and the public interests. So my plan after I graduate is to go back to Pakistan and work on climate issues. There's a great need for experts in the country, all the way from on the grassroots to try to understand the impact of climate change, to then sort of translate them into the language that's needed to be able to then secure financing, for example. So I hope to be a conduit between the global north, where a lot of the financing comes from, my country in the global south, where a lot of the climate change impacts are being felt, and sort of take their voices to places where we can sort of secure financing and make that work happen.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's very impressive. And that sounds like very interesting work. I'm excited to talk more about that once we kind of get into it. But I kind of changing gears a little bit. As part of your coursework for the fall semester, I understand you traveled to the COP28 conference in Dubai. Can you tell us a little bit more about that experience?
Of course. So I said earlier, I'm concentrating in international environmental policy at IU. So I'm very curious to, of course, see how negotiations happen at an international scale, specifically with regards to climate change. And I found this incredible opportunity at IU. Where this is a class offered from the Hamilton Lugar School by Professor Jessica O'Reilly called International Climate Governance, which takes approximately 16 students, 16 student delegates from IU to the Conference of Parties every year. This year, the Conference of Parties was held in Dubai, and it was the 28th iteration of the Conference of Parties. It was a significant one as well because this was going to be 5 years from the operationalization of the Paris Agreement. So there was going to be a global stocktake to assess how much progress has been made on the Paris Agreement. So throughout the semester, throughout the fall semester, we had seminar style classes once a week where all the delegates would come together in a classroom, try to understand how these international environmental agreements are forged, how they work, what are the clauses, what are the areas of concern, how can we ensure more equity in international environmental agreements, in international environmental conferences like this? And that was good training for us to then also eventually attend the conference itself in Dubai, where 16 of us, half of us attended it in the first week of the conference, and then the other half attended in the second week. All of us, of course, had different areas of research. Everyone is interested in different areas. Climate change, of course, spans very widely across a range of topics and themes. And everyone was sort of doing their own research while they were there. But it was an incredible week and a half in Dubai, where we got to meet and speak with and learn from the people who are really making the bigger decisions about climate change at an international scale.
Yeah, awesome. That sounds really interesting and it sounds like a great opportunity. I'm sure you guys were able to learn a lot and, were able to use all of the new things you've observed and learned into your own research as part of the course. So, for you, what would you say was the most interesting part of the convention for you?
I think what was incredibly interesting was how people from so many different walks of life came together in one space to try to reach an agreement about an issue which is truly global in scope. But just the breadth of the identities that were represented at the COP, I found to be really, really cool. Of course, there needs to be more work done as well in that regard, where we still see that there is more representation from the global north at these conferences. And there's less and less people from the global south. And there is a need to make that more equitable. But having said that, there still is quite a bit of representation from across the world. And there is representation for observers, there's representation for students like us who are just trying to research and trying to learn about what's happening. It's a great mechanism to also hold the world leaders accountable for their action. It's a great place where young climate activists from around the world also come together to rally behind the cause and to make their voices heard. You have indigenous peoples from across the world who are also represented. And I just think it's a fascinating space, a confluence of all areas of climate action under one event space for 2 weeks, trying to make things happen, which I thought was just incredibly cool to witness.
Yeah, absolutely. It does. It sounds very cool. So you mentioned, you know, the conference is also a place and a mechanism for people to hold world leaders accountable. And as a student studying international law at HLS, I am often met with the, I often read and kind of discuss in class kind of the limitations of international law and policy in trying to hold people accountable or in trying to actually get something kind of operationalize and, you know, truly implement the policies that they make at the global level in their, you know, national, you know, nations and whatever. So I guess that's also one of the major like criticisms of conventions or conferences like COP, that they're not, that they alone are not enough to solve global climate issues because of the whole accountability issue. So did going to the conference help clarify this skepticism for you at all? Or like, what was the general kind of like, you know, feeling or like general vibe that, you know, you felt when you were over there in terms of like accountability?
Yeah. I think it's completely fair to be skeptical of the process. And I think it's important to be skeptical of the process, because if we're, I think that being skeptical sort of also is part of holding people accountable for what they're doing at global, at this level. I think generally the vibe throughout the conference, because while we were there, you may have read in the news that the president of the conference this time was an ex oil executive from the UAE. There were some remarks that he made at the start of the conference, which were borderline climate denialism, which we, I think, during the conference felt more skeptical about whether or not it would reach the outcomes that we wanted. However, keeping that sort of skepticism on one side, if we sort of just objectively look at the progress that the COPs have made over the last 8 years that they have been meeting, I still think that their contributions have been significant enough where there is a need to continue to meet and try to force this form of collective action because of just the scope of the problem that we are facing. I think that there needs to remain, there need to be alternatives, of course, as well. For an issue like climate change, we shouldn't only be relying on these parties meeting once every year at the COP and trying to reach an agreement. Instead, one of Nobel laureates from our university, economist Eleanor Ostrom, and her work talks about the need for polycentricity, the idea that instead of thinking of climate change as one collective action problem, which of course the first best solution is to have a consensus across all countries to try to solve the problem. But if we aren't able to reach that, then we can also try to garner sort of more regional agreements between countries to try to solve those problems and try to reap the co-benefits that we get from reducing our use of carbon. Generally, when I was at the conference as well, and I think that's perfectly fine to have. But at the same time, there needs to constantly be a push from our end to make these conversations more productive and to make sure that there is no empty promises that are being made, and that we constantly follow up on making sure that the promises that are made at these conferences are followed up on, and that countries put money where their mouth is.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. And absolutely, I 100% agree with you on that. So I guess one could argue, I mean, it has already been argued, but research is definitely a way to try to, uncover more information about, you know, these climate issues, especially since, like, for several of them, like, not much scholarship has been completed. And it's also another way to kind of hold nations and leaders accountable, you know, by publishing their progress or lack of progress too. So in that context, you know, you mentioned that all of the student delegates at COP from IU had like a research topic in hand when they went. So could you please tell us more about, you know, what you were working on at that point?
Yeah, and I'd also sort of try to link this back to what you were saying about how research can also be a tool to try to drive that kind of accountability. I was researching loss and damage at this COP. Loss and damage is the idea that the impacts that we are seeing from climate change have gone beyond the phase of where we can try to mitigate and adapt. And now countries are actively facing losses and being damaged, both economic and non-economic, from climate disasters. As a result, there is a greater call from countries to be compensated in some way for the losses that they are facing that they haven't created themselves. If we look at historical emissions, of course, the greatest contributor to historical emissions is the country that we are in currently. The greatest emitter right now is China. There's the problem of climate change, as we all know, it has been created by few, but is being experienced by most. And it's disproportionately impacting countries who've had the least to do in causing the problem in the first place. So what had happened on the loss and damage front so far was that there has been in 2013 an agreement for a policy wing for loss and damage through the Warsaw International Mechanism. Later, there was also an agreement to set up a technical wing called the Santiago Network, which would provide technical assistance to countries in assessing loss and damage. And then finally, at COP27, there was an agreement to establish a finance mechanism for the loss and damage, which would be called the Loss and Damage Fund. It was operationalized only in the last few moments of COP27. And then in COP28, there was a transitional committee which forwarded recommendations to COP28 on how it would be established. So I was researching how what this fund was going to look like, how that money was going to reach frontline communities, what the processes would be that would be put into place. And we saw that on the very first day of the Conference of Parties, it came a little bit as a surprise to everyone as well, that the presidency adopted the recommendations of the transitional committee and established the Loss and Damage Fund on the very first day. However, the fund has been established, but there's still questions about capitalization of the fund. And that's the idea that we also need a steady flow of money in the fund to be able to actually get it to frontline communities. What we saw in terms of pledges that were made by countries to this fund were only a drop in the bucket for what is actually needed. Current estimates for annual need for loss and damage stand at about $400 billion. At the end of the 2 weeks, we only saw about $770 million be contributed, which is somewhere near 0.2% of what the actual need is. There was, of course, a greater need to capitalize a fund that activists were pushing for and are still pushing for even after the end of the conference. The second major problem with regards to loss and damage that we were trying to look at was to establish it as a third pillar of the Paris Agreement, with mitigation and adaptation being the first two pillars. And how this would have happened was if in the global stocktake text, which was eventually released at the end of COP28, had a very clear section addressing loss and damage as the third pillar of the Paris Agreement. However, it was only sort of included as an option. Developing countries had been pushing the UN Secretariat to the UNFCCC Secretariat to also do more research. And this is sort of linking back to the idea that you were talking about earlier about using research as a tool to hold country leaders accountable, to do more research on what the exact gaps were for loss and damage, so that we can, the figures that we currently throw out, the $400 billion that I'm telling you, has been done independently. And these aren't figures that are UN verified. So there was an idea to push for a report from the UN to actually do this research and find out, you know, how much was needed, how much has been done, and how much is predicted to be needed as climate impacts get worse and worse in the years to come. We saw that instead of that, at the Global Stocktake text just asks for a synthesis of all the reports that already exist on loss and damage, instead of like doing new research. And we felt that that was one of the places where the executive committee of the COP this year sort of fell short, because if that research had been mandated and eventually been done, it would also then help make that case to hold those leaders accountable, to put more finance towards loss and damage as well.
That was a very great answer. Thank you so much for that. There are a lot of points we could take off from, you know, your answer about your research and stuff like that. I think the first thing I'll talk about is, you know, you mentioned that a lot of the conversation surrounding COP and also just climate change in general is about, you know, historically how some nations have been the ones that contribute most to climate change and global warming, while generally countries in the global south have not contributed as much, but are, you know, experiencing and living the impacts of it today. So I guess it's a really big question, but like, how do we start thinking about, you know, trying to even out that sort of disparity, and like in terms of like, you know, what can countries in the global north do perhaps, or maybe what can countries in the global south do?
It is a difficult question, because I guess that's the question we've been asking ourselves this entire time as well. What can we do? I think the easy answer is to phase out all fossil fuels. And that's what this COP was also pushing for. What everyone was pushing for was for agreement on the phase out of fossil fuels. There is, of course, a historical responsibility that the global north has, but they're also, their emissions are also not continuing to decline in the way we would hope that they would, even at when we talk about it now. There is, I think, a need for the global north, firstly, to agree on phasing out all fossil fuels, and reach that agreement because if you think about it, mainly apart from your global north countries, we have a handful of countries from the global south that need to also significantly reduce their emissions, which may include Brazil, India, China, South Africa. These are the big countries that are coming to my head right now, who also need to significantly cut emissions. For them to cut emissions, what needs to also be done is a transfer of technology, which I think is also a responsibility of the global north, to ensure that cleaner technologies are being transferred to countries, so that they are their development is not hampered. It's not, I think the idea, of course, and why you were asking this question was also that there seems to be a trade-off, right? Do we develop, or do we, decide to cut our carbon emissions? We need to stop thinking of it as a trade-off and start introducing newer technologies, which we already do have access to and do have enough finance to be able to push that kind of those green technologies. It's just about actually making that transfer of skills happen from the global north to the global south. The transfer of capital needs to happen, where it, people can realize that they can still continue to develop and grow, but have green economies. So there is a need for a transfer of green technologies. Of course, the loss and damage fund is one of those things. You know, there is a need for greater finance to go towards countries that have already been impacted or will be impacted. Your small island developing states, which will be underwater, need to be compensated. There's some things that we can't do anything about, but where we can, I think we need to start diverting our finance and our skills and our capital towards that.
Awesome. Yeah, so the solution you seem to propose is that we kind of need a lot of work and a lot of collaboration from all sides and from, you know, all disciplines. And it's a process, but I think it's a process that a lot of people would, you know, appreciate happening, and, you know, it would definitely be for the better. Another thing you mentioned was, you know, starting conversations, which I think we've talked quite extensively about, you know, starting conversations on the international scale, or like, you know, you mentioned like domestic policies. So maybe like conversations on the national domestic scale as well. I guess we can continue to scale it down. A lot of people kind of feel overwhelmed when they think about climate change, me included, because it seems like such a daunting and big issue. Do you have any advice for people to like start having these conversations and start, you know, including themselves into local conversations about, you know, how we can go green, at least on a local level, maybe even like citywide level, like in Bloomington or as part of like IU?
Yeah, I think climate change generally is, it's daunting, right? Like thinking about it, it's also such a huge issue, has so many different aspects to it. It's difficult to really think about what your role can be in trying to solve this planetary crisis that we are facing. What I would suggest, and this is a question that I struggle with myself as well all the time, what I would suggest and what's worked for me is to try to pick my battles. Think about one area of climate which you think you are passionate about, whether that is climate justice, or that can be something as simple as your day-to-day recycling and just composting. You know, like think about what capacity you have to contribute to climate change conversations, and then make that decision on how much you are doing. Of course, staying involved in with climate activist groups on campus is a great way. Regardless of wherever we are on this planet, we are being affected by climate change all around us. And there are members of our community who are being impacted disproportionately. And it's important to meet with your local climate activist group to try to understand who those communities are and see how you can help specifically in that regard. And for that, I think at IU, the Students for a New Green World is a great community that's been rallying the cause, and continue to listen to people talking about climate change, I think, is also being part of the conversation. Sometimes all it takes is as easy as listening to this podcast and, you know, hearing what other people have to say and what their opinions are and what their perspectives are.
That's a perfect answer. Thank you so much. And, you know, before we part ways, I guess my last question for you is, if there is one thing you would like the listeners to take away from this episode, what is it?
I think if there's one thing, I would just say, keep talking about climate change, keep listening to people of different perspectives about how climate is impacting them differently, and try to empathize with them as much as you can and see how you can offer your own resources, capacity to try to make it easier for them. And if we're not all in it together, then there's no way that we can try to solve this.
On that note, I will do the wrap up. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Hereabouts Asian American Midwest Radio. Hereabouts is produced by WFHB Community Radio and Indiana University's Asian Culture Center. We ask critical questions about identity, culture, community, and shared assumptions. We air every other Wednesday from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. in the evening. Please stay tuned for our episodes in the future and our episodes this spring semester. This was Belle, and thank you so much to our guest speaker, Oase, and we hope you enjoyed this week's episode.